Hi, it's Dave. Welcome. Today, I'm joined by Jared Isaacman. He is the CEO and founder of Shift 4, and also he was the commander of Inspiration 4 mission, the first all-civilian crew to space. I want to welcome Jared on the show. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Great. Yeah. First, I want to congratulate you on a successful Inspiration 4 mission. You guys raised over $200 million for St. Jude's Children's Hospital. You gave $100 million personally. Elon Musk chipped in with another $50 million. And you guys gave a ton of publicity to St. Jude's Children's Hospital. I think it was just an awesome mission altogether, remarkable. Thank you on behalf of everyone, you know, who was watching and supporting this.
I was super lucky to be part of it, and we're actually over 250 million now. So, work doesn't end. St. Jude has an unbelievable vision, just as SpaceX does, and in their case, it's that no child should die in the dawn of life. And we've got a long way to go to kind of fulfill and deliver upon that. So, going to keep raising funds and awareness.
Awesome. Yeah, I noticed. I've been reading up and watching a lot of your past interviews and your history, and it seems like you've piloted fighter jets and you're comfortable with a lot of risky situations. I'm curious about your wife and kids. Were they nervous for you at all, you know, for this whole mission to space?
I think there were points for sure with my wife leading up to it, like the couple days going into it. You know, we've been together, for a very long time right now. I mean, she's, she was like the 12th employee at the company back in the day. So she's seen my, entire, aviation career over, 20 years. Like she's seen me flying air shows. So she's not like, wasn't totally shocked. Now my kids, like, they were all about Baby Yoda and everything. Like they didn't know that people's, moms and dads aren't going up into space every day. So I don't think they fully appreciated some of the risk elements to it. Maybe a little bit at the end though.
Yeah. What did you tell your kids in terms of why you're doing this? Why are you going to space and leading this mission?
Yeah, I mean, I guess what I tried to explain is that, this is important kind of for the future. It is a more, interesting world when people can journey among the stars. And the idea that, we could live in a Jetsons-like future where people are jumping in their rocket ship, and that there are, questions that people, especially as they get older, have been asking themselves since, like, the beginning of humankind, and the answers are probably out there. So it's important to keep making steps in that direction. But I also try to emphasize the importance of what we're doing, for here on Earth as well, and why St. Jude was so important. In fact, I'm like really looking forward to getting them to the hospital and the research center so they can kind of see what I've seen firsthand.
Mm, that's awesome. I noticed I was watching the Netflix series, which was great, and it seems like your kids are quite young. What ages are they, if you don't mind?
So my oldest just turned 8, actually like a little over a week ago, and my youngest is 5.
Okay, got it. Yeah, my kids are 4 and 7, almost around the same age. What values or what are you trying to impart to your kids? And was this Inspiration 4 kind of part of a bigger strategy or kind of hope of what you're trying to, give to your kids?
Well, I mean, I think a big part of Inspiration 4 is right in the name, which is it's about inspiring people and not just about the things in space, things that we can accomplish here on Earth, and that you can set your sights on things that can be, at one point in time considered like completely impossible or unimaginable. I mean, that's certainly what SpaceX does all the time. I mean, they're very big in bringing things from the sci-fi world and the movies here to us in reality. So there's an inspiring element for it, for sure. I hope that my kids will grow up and look to, Haley and Cyan, two females that were part of the mission when, they've been way underrepresented in human spaceflight's history, and look to that as a source of inspiration. Obviously there's other things too that are outside of Inspiration 4 that I try and, impart on my kids that, were helpful in how I, was raised and, shaped some of my, life.
Yeah, yeah. I'm curious, what are those kind of values, or what do you hope to, leave for your kids?
Oh, well, certainly independence is a big thing. Going out and, independence, responsibility, self-reliance, the drive to go out and want to create things yourself and not wait for them to come to you. You know, there's a lot of things that I look back on that were, you know, kind of pivotal in what shaped my trajectory. So I take it in stages, though, because they are 8 and 5.
Yeah.
Want them to have like just a killer childhood too. So
yeah, I hear you. I'll go ahead and link to that Netflix series on Inspiration 4. I thought it was fantastic. For those who don't know about Inspiration 4, or if you're President Biden, you're still needing to find out more about it. anyways, I'm curious about SpaceX and Elon Musk. What did you learn about SpaceX or Elon Musk that perhaps, you know, the rest of us don't know about SpaceX? Was there anything kind of throughout the whole process that kind of surprised you or was particularly interesting?
Yes. Like, we could easily spend an hour talking about it all. I mean, I spent, you know, basically a year, you know, inside, you know, SpaceX and was completely just blown away. I mean, obviously from the outside looking in, I was always a SpaceX fan because I'm a aviation space enthusiast. Plus, you know, I started a defense aerospace company 11 years ago that had a lot of the same challenges that Elon and SpaceX did, where you're working against like an establishment that doesn't want innovation, that likes, you know, slow and steady and costly, which is unfortunate because it all impedes progress. And, you know, we had to break into that in our defense aerospace business, and SpaceX had a lot to work against in order to deliver us, you know, what is like just an extraordinary capability today. So I was always a fan outside, but, you know, once I got to see how it worked inside, I was, again, it is the most innovative and well-run organization. Like, this is not, you know, a visionary just jumping up and down and expecting people to, you know, create things out of thin air. Like, it's incredibly well-run. You know, it starts having a great vision and mission, which attracts the best talent. I think that's something like a lot of companies should, you know, ground themselves into, like, you know, aspiring to make life multi-planetary. Is one hell of a vision, and it's going to attract some people that, you know, will believe that there is no, you know, greater impact they can make on the world than working at that company. So they do benefit from incredible talent, but they have great philosophies, like, you know, Elon's first principles approach to things, and it's supported by a lot of other philosophies, help them achieve things that others can't. So, you know, not to pick favorites in the whole space, you know, game right now, but, like, you know, Blue Origin was started before SpaceX. You know, Jeff Bezos is a very capable entrepreneur, and he certainly was able to provide more capital and resources to Blue Origin than SpaceX had initially, but still, look at what SpaceX accomplished relative to Blue Origin. I mean, they're landing rockets on ships, not once, you know, 100 times, and nobody else has done it even once. So, clearly there's more to it than just a visionary. Like, there's a lot of substance inside that organization that makes it able to achieve what it's able to do.
Mm-hmm. Some people might, you know, be critical of, like, oh, why are we going to space or spending money when, you know, we have problems on Earth? Is there anything kind of about space exploration that you're seeing that can unlock a lot of innovation, technology, economic value? Do you think there's something where space is kind of underrated in a sense of what it holds for humankind? Is there any kind of sense of intuition where you're thinking that actually space really, really is important, much bigger than perhaps, you know, most people realize?
Yeah, I mean, I understand the arguments. Like, I try and look at everything from both sides. And look, there is a lot of suffering in the world, but there has been throughout human history, too. That doesn't mean we hit the pause button and not try and make progress. You can do both, especially when one directly benefits the other. But for sure, you could imagine rewinding, you know, the clock, you know, go like, you know, 20, 30 years ago. Why are we putting up cell phone towers right now? You know, people don't even have clean water in the world, and yet we're enabling this technology that allows rich people in their cars to have car phones. Like, you know, that's not, maybe 30 or 40 years ago, right?
Yeah.
But, like, you can certainly point to plenty of examples on that throughout history. This is why Inspiration 4 tried to balance both. Like, we're not ignoring the realities of today, and there shouldn't be childhood cancer in the world. And if we are going to get to Mars someday, then we certainly should conquer childhood cancer along the way. Like, you know, so, like, you're able to solve for some of the issues today while making progress for tomorrow. I don't think people fully appreciate all that, you know, affordable access to orbit is capable of doing for the Earth. Like, you know, when you had just, United Launch Alliance. Let's, for example, a joint venture between Boeing and Lockheed. Nothing about that sounds inexpensive, right? And you could only, every launch is $250 million. Well, you had to be pretty selective about what you put in orbit. Every one of them had to count. Now we can experiment with numerous different cube satellites and put them on orbit for relatively low cost when you're able to reuse the rocket for every single launch, right? We can put up satellites that tell us more about our climate. We can have satellites, that hone in on natural disasters and, have life-saving measures associated with it. How about just the Starlink initiative alone? You have 4 billion people in the world that have no access to broadband connectivity. You're not going to run fiber across the Amazon. You're not going to run fiber across deserts. But broadband connectivity, I think information is like the foundation to solving all of the world's problems. Think about it, whether it's healthcare and you have telemedicine, whether it's climate change, you can do so much with more information. And that's exactly what Starlink is able to do. But 20 years ago, if you didn't have a SpaceX and you were dealing with a single monopoly of a launch provider, it would have been completely unaffordable. So yeah, I don't think everybody, fully appreciates the benefit of, low cost orbit can provide the world.
Yeah, yeah. I think like you're saying, like Starlink, just the impact on broadband for the rural poor and those who don't have access, it's just going to be revolutionary, providing educational opportunities, economic opportunities. It's going to be just revolutionary, I think. And it's all possible through, space exploration and the rocket technologies. I tweeted out to my followers, like, hey, what kind of questions do you have for Jared Isaacman here? And we've got a bunch of different people, but Kevin McCabe and several others asked the same question. And the question is, how was the bathroom situation on board the Dragon capsule? So, yeah, can you explain, how did you guys do your business there?
Yeah, there is a bathroom. Yeah, you don't get the most privacy. But I would liken it to, a good camping trip or something. You're not doing it for the comforts. Going to space right now, look, it's a everything about putting something into space is all about weight. It's a mass problem because you have to accelerate it to 17,500 miles an hour. It means you don't have a lot of space, you don't have a lot of comforts, but what you do have is a vantage point unlike any other. And we were incredibly lucky to see the world from a perspective that few others have had, and do a lot of research and science and raise good awareness for causes like St. Jude. So all of that to me is worth a little bit of an uncomfort at times when it comes to the bathroom situation. But lots of redundancy, totally manageable, all good.
Okay, so there was a bathroom at least. How about sleep? Were you able to get some good sleep, or was it kind of on and off your sleep?
Yeah, look, there's a lot of things different. There's a lot of physiological changes when you get into space. I would say that we were kind of prepared in advance that, 50% of people really like sleeping in space and 50% hate it. I think in our case, it was 25% really liked it and 75% didn't. Not a big deal at all. But since you are floating, basically, if you're the kind of sleeper who likes to curl up in your bed, sleep on your side, sleep on your stomach, you're not going to like space. And if you're kind of the sleeper who likes to sleep on your back, you're going to like it. And it's because you basically just stretch out. Your spinal column completely uncompresses and you're bored. And again, if you sleep on your back, it's kind of comparable and you're probably really happy about it. But if you like to curl up or something and cocoon yourself in bed, you don't get that benefit because the moment you fall asleep, you turn into a board.
Got it. Were you part of the 75 or the 25%?
I'm 75.
Got it. Newly Agile on Twitter says, do you have any plans to create another mission like Inspiration 4 in the future?
I've kind of said from the start, I think we set the bar really high with Inspiration 4. We accomplished so much in that one mission. And anything that would come thereafter, would have to rise up to that standard. So it would have to make a profound impact on the world. Everybody understands space is expensive. It will come down, no question, with time, just as other major, pioneering technology has. But while it is expensive, you just have to use those missions to make a profound impact on the world. So if we can accomplish that, then for sure. It would be an incredible privilege to be able to go back.
Interesting. Yeah. For the funding of the actual, like, you know, rocket launch, was that from your pockets that you gave to SpaceX? So,
absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Got it.
Wow. Definitely. I'd commingle that with the
I hear you. Wow. All right. So I want to go dive into your personal life story a bit. I find it, really fascinating. Just your history of being in high school and not being happy in high school. I think it's around 15, 16 or so that you dropped out of high school, ended up taking the GED. Can you take us back to your high school and what was it like? Why weren't you happy? What about the situation? I mean, in one interview, I heard you say, like, oh, you weren't very fond of having to raise your hand, you know, just to go to the bathroom, just all that restriction, right, stuff. But yeah, what was your mindset back in high school and how did you view things?
Yeah, and so kind of to what I mentioned before with my kids, you know, I was raised to be, very independent, lots of, you know, self-reliance. You know, if you want something, you're going to work for it to get it. And, excessive structure of high school, you know, you don't really get to pick any of the classes you want to, you know, that interests you. I'm not much of a morning person, so the early wake-ups weren't great. And meanwhile, you know, my older siblings, I mean, my brother's 15 years older than me, my sister is 13 years older, and my other brother's 10 years older than me. So while I was enduring high school, you know, they were out having careers, you know, and, since I was working from the age you could get working papers, probably younger than that, in order to, you know, get the things I wanted in life, it just seemed so much more appealing to do, to work. And, it was not without a plan, just to be clear. I had started a company when I was 15, did computer repair and web design. And I was working at a computer retailer called CompUSA to basically poach clients. And a payments company came in and, they had some issues and I did what we intended to do, which was poach a client. And it gave me some exposure to an industry that was like at such an incredible point with so much opportunity. I mean, there were a lot of elements that were being neglected while, new emerging markets, at least for payments, were coming out, like e-commerce in the late 90s. So, I didn't leave without a plan. I did have a plan. And I was kind of lucky, again, like a lot of things in life, you know, to have that exposure at such an early age to the payments industry.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess through your kind of early job, I guess it was with MSI, correct, where you were hired as a consultant. And did you just see a lot of like backward things, just slow moving things in the payment processing industry? And was that part of the motivation where, like, you know, I guess first off, you had a job that you could rely on to drop out of school. But shortly after, I think I was reading 6 months after, you know, starting with MSI, you started your own company to try to do payment processing better. Like, where did that come up? Did you want to start a company early on in your life? Or was that just something, you know, opportunity came up and you're like, well, it makes sense to do it?
Yeah, no, this is just luck again. I hated my boss at MSI. And but it was that coupled with opportunity too. So the 90s were all about issuance and acceptance for payment. So we got to get credit cards in people's wallet and get them to spend like crazy. And, you know, the neglected portion of it was about acceptance. And that was really just based on the idea that, you know, businesses will always, you know, conduct commerce with consumers the way they want to, you know, conduct commerce with them. So the idea was like, make it really easy to get a credit card and the whole acceptance side will just figure it out. And it meant it was really painful. So, you know, 1999, you could get a credit card in 60 seconds on the internet and it would be in the mail 3 days later. But if you were a pizza place and you wanted to take credit cards, it was comparable to getting a commercial mortgage. It was tons of paperwork and there was outsourcing like you wouldn't believe. Like banks wanted nothing to do with it. So you had like quasi fintechs, you know, really early, just mostly like I just call like IT servicing companies that were, you know, again, outsource to multiple layers. And it just was painful. So that was really the opportunity I saw. And again, you know, didn't like my boss, so I left and created what ultimately was Shift4. Mostly in day one was just about bringing things in-house and creating operational, you know, efficiencies to give a better experience for, you know, our distribution partners and ultimately the customer. You know, it started to obviously evolve quite a bit from there over the last 22 years.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned earlier about like your values of independence, self-reliance, creating for yourself. How was like elementary and junior high school for you? I mean, you're in a school system, I'm assuming, that's very just structured and perhaps rigid. Did you have some tension with the structure around you?
Not as much so until high school, I would say. Like, I think that, I mean, just to be clear, like, I do think structure is very important. I like the tried and proven, you know, well-worn path of, you know, higher education and such. And I did wind up getting a college degree later on. Not super compatible with me in, I guess, during the high school years. But, you know, elementary school, middle school, I'd say were pretty normal.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And then your family, were they pretty supportive of you, like, you know, when you're dropping out, starting your own business and all this, or were they kind of skeptical, or you know, what was your kind of relationship with your parents?
I'd say surprisingly supportive. Like, I even think back on it, you know, and knowing all the battles that were fought, and just I'm surprised that actually went as smoothly as it did. And it was probably because you know, I had a decent enough plan that, you know, they could buy off on.
Yeah. When you're 16 and you're starting your own business, I'm sure there are different people or voices around that are saying like, oh, you can't do that. You're too young. You're too inexperienced. Just, you know, a bunch of reasons. How did you process that? Did you just ignore the noise, or was there something inside where you're like, you know, no, I think I can do this? Like, where did that kind of confidence come from, you think?
You know, I don't really recall too many, you know, naysayers at the time. I mean, really, those first couple of years, I just remember being like bunkered down in the basement, not seeing a lot of daylight. I was surrounded by like a team of, you know, very close friends, you know, that shared vision, and we really had nothing else going on. So, I mean, it was just work. We tried to, you know, I guess, insulate ourselves from any criticism by not really revealing our ages or, you know, the immaturity of the company. Like, we created the company name in the beginning was called United Bank Card because it sounded like an old institution. And, you know, we didn't really leave the basement so that people could see us face to face to know that we were teenagers.
And then the story I was reading, your dad would go out and do sales calls for you guys, I guess. And I was looking at your website. It seems like your dad is still on the board of directors. How was that? It seems like it would be like an ideal setup almost, in a sense your dad is like kind of covering for your young age, at least in the early, you know, innings of the business. How did it progress over the years? And how was his role, you know, as a father to you in business?
Definitely one of the more rewarding experiences in my life, getting to work with my dad. And no question, those early years, you know, basically myself and Brendan, you know, Chuck Efron, some of these guys who were there from the beginning, we were focusing on building, you know, kind of the early infrastructure, if you will, for third-party distribution. The idea of, instead of like, you know, hand-to-hand combat, winning one customer at a time, you know, empowering distribution to win hundreds or thousands of customers with a better experience was the way to go, and making their lives easier. My father was out there doing that hand-to-hand combat, winning our first, you know, handful of like small and mid-sized customers, and yeah, he was the wise face that you know, more mature, I guess would be the way to describe it. You know, to go out and do that while we essentially hid in the basement. And he's been a huge, you know, influence on me. You know, I point out, like, I really had two mentors over, you know, my career with Shift4. One is my father, he's diplomatic. He's a people person. You're going to inspire more people, and people are going to be more loyal, and you're going to be able to win over relationships if people generally like you. And that's a lot that I've taken from my father and his approach. And on the other end of the spectrum, my other mentor was one of the founders of MSI. And he was very tough love with a lot of street smarts. And he was the complete other end of the spectrum. And I think as I've matured as, you know, as a leader over the years, I've wound up with this, you know, blend of the two.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. I want to dive into your company Shift4 a bit. It's a $4 billion market cap company. It's recently IPO'd. It has over 1,000 employees. Gonzalez Fernandez on Twitter was saying, Shift4 is a highly complex business, and a quick overview of the business while simplifying the jargon would be helpful for people to understand what they do and how they differentiate from legacy payment providers. And then Daniel Endy says, please explain your strategy for Shift4 in simple terms. So yeah, can you give us kind of, you know, the 411, the overview on Shift4, what makes it different, you know, than other payment companies?
Yeah, so it's easy. Well, I hope it's easy enough for me to explain. It's a pretty common question. You know, my career in payments began in the end of the 90s, which is really the 1.0 period of payments. And we were pioneers in the 2.0, which is the integrated world where you bring together software plus payments to deliver a commerce experience. So I have a perspective on what would be considered, you know, the legacy providers, which is those, you know, that consolidated like crazy from the 1.0 period. And then, you know, what we kicked off, which was the 2.0 phase. So the way I like to describe this is, you know, a Pangea-like example. So at one point in time in the payments world, it was just one giant continent. And it was all about, you know, payment enablement for everyone. Like, you wanted to take credit cards. It's incredibly simple. It's very binary. It either approves or it declines. And if it approves, it spits out a receipt. And that was kind of this 1.0 phase. And these are those little brick terminals you still see in Visa commercials that just, you know, do an approval or decline, and that's essentially it. And what's happened, now we kicked this off, you know, about 17 years ago, but it's especially, you know, relevant over the last, call it 10 years, is this 2.0 phase. And that's where, you know, the tectonic plates start shifting and entire land masses break away, and not everyone can do everything in payments. It's no longer as simple as an approval or decline. And these are where these technology platforms emerge, where, yes, you're doing payments, but you're also doing so much more for the customer. You're supplying them with software. You're doing, you know, business intelligence, analytics, you know, and one great example of a landmass that broke away would be Square. And once this landmass breaks away, it is very, very hard for anyone to encroach upon it. It is no longer as simple as an approval or a decline. And no matter how big of an organization you are, like a JP Morgan or Bank of America, you can jump up and down, but you can never be what that landmass is now, like a Square. It's very, very sticky and very hard to encroach upon. Well, in the case of Shift4, what we did is went to the exact opposite end of the commerce spectrum where you find Square, which is single application that does an awful lot for the business, you know, food truck, coffee shop, bakery, generally something you can download on an iPad and it's good to go. We're on the other end where it's not one piece of software, it's lots of software. So examples of our customers would be like Pebble Beach or Hilton or Hyatt, where you have software for the hotel, software for the golf course, software for the salon or spa. And the software is made from different companies like Microsoft or Oracle. But it all has to work seamlessly together. It all has to be secure, so some common encryption across it. And then you can drive analytics and then, of course, do authorizations and settlement. Now, being in the most complex end of the commerce spectrum, where you find us is, you know, 40% of the hotels in the country, 33% of the restaurants. If you're going skiing this winter, you're probably going to see Shift4 on a screen somewhere. UPS stores, major stadiums. Much more demanding environments, more complicated environments. And, you know, to give you a sense of like that 1.0 phase of where the legacy providers are to that point of the question, you know, that's non-integrated, non-software driven transactions. Like 99.9% of the 200 billion in payment volume we touch at Shift4 originates through software and would be in those verticals that I just described.
Mm-hmm. So expounding on your kind of landmass analogy there. So we have like Square, you know, as a landmass providing, you know, more of these, let's say, more simple applications to restaurants, food trucks, et cetera. You're saying like Shift4 provides kind of a more complex or solutions for more complex environments, like a Pebble Beach Resort, hotel, salon, all this stuff. Does that, do you think, make it even a more sticky landmass if, you know, you're bringing together all these kind of complex environments where it's so essential as a kind of glue to everything? And like, is that one of your competitive advantages, just the whole durability, the stickiness of your solutions?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the whole kind of idea is once those landmasses break off, it is very, very hard for anyone to encroach upon the space. In our case, we have 425 different software integrations and 20 years of version history behind it. You just can't replicate it. It's essentially, you know, impossible. So, you know, and the same is really applicable for others. I mean, in the case of like Shopify would be a great, you know, landmass example. Now, it's possible that you can outgrow it at some point and say, like, you know, maybe we'll go to a Salesforce Commerce Cloud or like an Adobe or something of that effect. But generally, once they're in that environment, they're there. The same applies for Square. You can certainly outgrow it. You don't see like, you know, 20 location, you know, restaurants with lots of different software running on Square. But yeah. But if you fit within that, you know, that kind of, you know, target of their verticals, very, very hard to encroach upon the same that space. And the same is applicable to us.
So. Got it. All right. So let's survey a bit of this competitive environment here. So you mentioned Square as more the simple kind of application. Shift for the more complex, let's say, hotels, restaurants, resorts, stadiums, et cetera. Shopify would be more of the online kind of e-commerce store. Would you put Stripe in there as well? Or would you say that they're not, I mean, yeah, would that be part of it? Or are they just more providing kind of like functions for people?
I mean, the first general like statement I make is like commerce in the world is huge. There's an awful lot of, there's rarely winner take all. And just given how vast it is, there are, you know, 2.0 specialists, if you will, that focus on certain sweet spots in it. Like you can absolutely like love Square and Shift4 knowing that we have zero overlap in the market. Like Square will continue to grow on the simplified end of the spectrum, will continue to grow really well on a more complex end. Stripe is an example of like another great landmass that, you know, broke away. But they enable like really single software solutions. Like if you make a killer app for an iPad and you want to monetize your relationship with your customer via payments, you're probably going to wind up at Stripe. We would be much closer to like Adyen, if you will. Adyen definitely plays in the more complex end of the commerce spectrum. You know, that's who powers, you know, Uber and, you know, Microsoft. And like, if especially on a global commerce level, they're actually really in a league of their own, although we aspire to be there. You know, one signature win I'm sure a lot of your, you know, kind of viewers are interested about is SpaceX Starlink. Mm-hmm. You know, that's coming from an Adyen. They definitely deal with some of the most demanding, you know, kind of customers in the world. We obviously do, you know, a lot of different things like sports and entertainment, restaurants, hotels, and gaming and such that would be, you know, a departure from an Adyen. But in terms of like complex commerce, software-driven payments, you know, global aspirations, you know, we have definitely similarities in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Got it. In terms of like your core, like your restaurant business, would you say Toast would be a competitor to you guys?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Okay. I mean, we probably, you know, split up, you know, the vertical a little bit where we're probably on the more, you know, complex side of it again, like our customers with Tao and Hakkasan and Ruth Chris Steakhouse and such where, you know, we have an advantage with local distribution. It's really important. If you can imagine, like on a Friday night, a printer goes down, you want somebody there, you know, who's economically aligned around payments to want to sort it out. We have a third party distribution strategy like that. Toast is more direct. So software's got to be a little bit simpler, appeal to merchants that may not be as sensitive to those things, you know, again, on a Friday night. But Toast is an absolute winner in the space. And so are we. In fact, I would think, you know, it's really just Shift4 and Toast that are growing, you know, payment volume at a pretty extraordinary rate in restaurants, which is fine. Like there's never a winner take all. And I like being in a landscape of, you know, two, which is good. But they just do restaurants. We obviously do so much more, you know.
Yeah. If you take the restaurant space, where is this headed? Is it just like expanding the services and the scope of software to all functions of the restaurant? Like, you know, for example, payroll and just all forms of, you know, what the restaurant does. Is it even going to marketing, helping, you know, re-engage customers, giving like coupons or notifications? Like, where does this, you know, eventually head?
Well, really what you're talking about now is like, what pain points are you trying to solve for the customer? Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you look at, you know, Toast and even Square does the same thing. You have payroll options, you have capital offerings. You have to consider, like, again, what customer, who's your target customer, and is that one of their pain points? Now, if you've got a bakery, you know, on the corner, you know, you might want to take a Toast or Square capital offering where you're getting 10 grand and you're paying back 15 in 6 months. I can tell you, like, a Tao or a Hakkasan or Ruth Chris, you know, is never going to take, you know, like 150% APR money. On the same note, like, you know, if you have, you know, 10 employees in a bakery, you might absolutely use Square Payroll or Toast Payroll or something. You know, if you have 400 employees across 20 locations, you're probably with an ADP or a, you know, or a paycheck. So we didn't, you know, we didn't prioritize payroll or capital just given who our target market is. We did things like QR code based ordering and QR code payments and, you know, business intelligence and analytics or marketing products. Sure, know your customer. You know, you can have a reputation management. We just elected to solve different pain points based on where in the market we chose to play. And they're not just applicable for restaurants. Like, they're across all the various verticals we support.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Dis Martian from Twitter says, what are the broad implications of Starlink payments agreement for Shift4? And is the agreement worldwide? And then, oh, yeah, that's the question.
The implications are huge for us, and it is a global agreement. So, one of the key obligations we shared was just moving the domestic payment volume over, within a short period of time of the contract execution. And the reason for that is because we can do USA processing all day long. We'd handle $200 billion in payment volume. However, we have really no international capabilities at all. And that's why Starlink is so important, because if you not only is Starlink a global customer, which gives you the justification to go solve for that, you know, organically or inorganically, and probably very likely inorganically to do that, which is fantastic justification. But when you do it, you know, you increase the TAM for every one of the other verticals you're in. So, like, we're a category leader in sports and entertainment stadiums in the U.S. Our software works just fine in a Manchester United or, you know, stadiums in Europe or South. We just have no payments capabilities there. So when we solve for SpaceX, knowing that that was not capability driven, you're talking global commerce. You're talking Adyen and Adyen alone. That was relationship driven, where it's, hey, we know you guys are good in the U.S., don't have international capabilities, but we're going to be patient. And we're going to tell you the things we like about who we use today, and we'll tell you about the things that could be done better. And we will give you the yellow brick road to having, you know, a great global commerce type capability. So you've got Starlink, like, ushering you along on that yellow brick road. And then while you're solving for them, you know, now you can, you know, go after stadiums on a global level, gaming on a global level, your hotels. I mean, geez, our customers, you know, our Hyatt, Hilton, Radisson, you know, Mandarin Oriental. We're doing a great job for them domestically. We can do a great job for them internationally. Starlink gives us the justification to do so. So it's huge TAM expansion for us.
Wow. I mean, that sounds huge. What percent of kind of your business is in the U.S.?
Like, all of it.
Really? Wow. That's crazy. So, I mean, if your whole business is in the U.S., I mean, Starlink, you know, it seems like it's forcing you or motivating you guys. You have to now, like, expand, you know, wherever Starlink is expanding. Starlink is expanding very rapidly, different countries like Europe and stuff. Are you already seeing the benefits of this? Like, you know, having to process payments or prepare for payments in Europe and then seeing, okay, we can build now from this kind of, you know, this point into, you know, a whole operation, let's say, in different countries in Europe.
Yeah, this is just so important. I mean, we've been getting questions since, you know, the testing the waters before our IPO about what are we doing internationally? Because it is rather obvious when you look at who all of our international, you know, all of our hotel customers are international. So why wouldn't you do this? But we had a hard time, especially over the last, you know, year and change, where there's only so many international assets that, you know, they're not Starlink ready day one. Like, if they were, they'd be competing with Adyen, and they're not. So, you know, there are assets that are out there. They're call it like factories, to use that analogy, and you have to retool them if you want to play on an Adyen-like level on a global basis. Now, that coupled with, like, incredibly high valuation expectations over the last 18 months, you know, kind of deterred us, you know, from pulling the trigger on that. I mean, we have tons of cash, so we certainly have the means to do it, but you don't want to overpay. You don't want to make a mistake. Now, Starlink changes that game. The fact that valuation expectations have come down in the market, you know, just are that much more of a motivator to go and pull the trigger on these things. So, there's no question that, to give you an example, 8 months ago, we pay a premium for a European, you know, payment service provider acquirer that has some weird niche, you know, like, call it, like, supporting, like, I don't know, amusement rides or something in the region. It would have been very hard to explain the strategic rationale to our investors on why that was an important initiative. Now we can say, look, disregard what they're doing today. It's immaterial. It's bonus points if it's, like, accretive, but reality is, like, we just bought a factory and we're going to now be able to satisfy volume demand for Starlink across Europe. And we're energizing our sports and entertainment team and our gaming team and our hotel team. You know, the capability. So it's a huge game changer.
Amazing. Is it is Europe the next big kind of obvious target then for you guys?
For sure. I mean, you get a lot of bang for your buck there because it's cross-European acquiring licenses allow you to go in, you know, pretty much every country except, you know, the United Kingdom. So versus other parts of the world, like, you know, we move into Canada, that, you know, the hoops we have to jump through are specific to Canada. You know, you want to move into Mexico, it's specific to Mexico. So it's a long, hard road when you go through like LATAM, for example, versus, you know, you get to kill a lot of birds with one stone in Europe. So just thinking through our existing customers and relationships, and then obviously Starlink, it's very logical to start in Europe.
Yeah. Do you think this Starlink agreement would have happened without Inspiration 4?
No.
Yeah. Can you share anything about like how it came about? Like, was it just, you know, more organic, just like, you know, conversation, I don't know, went to it? Or did you guys just build trust and you guys liked each other so much? You're like, you know, I don't know, and whom was it at the very top, the decisions were just quickly made? I'm just curious, like, if you can share anything about, you know, kind of the process.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that there is a great relationship there. So I'm personally an investor in SpaceX. I've participated in the last two rounds. Shift4 is an investor in SpaceX. I think it's like just good capital allocation. It's going to appreciate. And, you know, were those investments alongside, you know, Inspiration 4, which I think was pretty successful. I mean, look, if you, you know, if you want to have, you know, people, you know, colonizing Mars, you know, putting, you know, a million people, you got to start somewhere. And that first kind of all civilian mission, where you're opening up space to everyone, you know, that going right, you know, was a, I think, a key stepping stone for all the others to follow. So, yeah, we didn't deserve it from a capabilities perspective. Mm-hmm. We're awesome in the USA, but we're no Adyen internationally. It was relationship driven, and it was done with the understanding that, you know, you're gonna need some patience, and you're gonna need to help us along. But I am confident if they're drawing out the yellow brick road of telling us what's ideal, you know, we're gonna put together quite a capability that should, you know, at least take a step beyond what's currently available in the market.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And regarding Shift4's investment in SpaceX, how much is that? How much was invested in SpaceX by Shift4?
I want to say approximately $30 million two rounds ago. So, mm-hmm. You know, would have had a nice appreciation since then. Mm-hmm.
Got it. Archie Cameron on Twitter says, what's the best advice you have for young people to achieve success in the future?
I think most of the missteps I see since that wasn't specific to an entrepreneurial question, I would say, look, follow the traditional path if you're looking for the best odds. You know, it is a well-worn road that gives you exposure and opportunity in life to then, you know, kind of pick and choose where you want to, you know, prioritize your energy. So, I mean, just generally speaking, you know, going to school, doing internships, getting broad exposure, and then, you know, gravitating towards something that you're passionate about is immensely important. You know, I typically surround myself with the people that are absolutely the best at what they do. And the people the best at what they do are doing something that genuinely like stimulates them and they find interesting. I've never met anyone who's like exceptional and hated their job or hated the industry or that they're working in. So, you know, take all the opportunities you can to have good exposure. The other thing too is like, you know, steady as she goes, lots of missteps with wild speculation. And, you know, look, there's plenty of things in the last 2 years that have emerged to speculate on. And even, you know, kind of short-term gains don't point towards long-term success. So I'd be careful looking for shortcuts, to, you know, emphasize that point enough. Mm-hmm. But if it's entrepreneurial, I would say you got to find opportunity. I mean, that is just, there's a reason why, you know, like two-thirds of businesses fail in the first year is you're jumping on something that is interesting, you know, but there might not actually be any real opportunity against it to support a good business. And it's a long way of saying that they were doomed to fail from the start. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the opportunity, interesting. There's been a few quotes from you about kind of comparing life to this, the limited flight hours of an airplane, right? And you only have a limited number of useful hours in your life. Thus, you want to make the most of it and live it to the full. Like, where did that come from? And how does that kind of shape your decisions, like, on a day-to-day basis?
Well, I guess being a pilot, you know, for the last 17 years, but maybe even more so in, you know, starting a defense aerospace company where we own the world's largest fleet of fighter jets, which we bought from other countries. And generally speaking, when a country is ready to sell you their fighter jets, it's either because of, like, significant obsolescence or they've used up every bit of the fatigue life. So, it became a big part of, like, our aircraft, you know, hunting, you know, philosophy to find, you know, light jets that still had a lot of life left into them. But it wasn't hard to, like, you know, it just within a pilot community to share, like, look, we only get so many hours at this. And I do think, like, you're not fulfilling your purpose in life unless you're maximizing, like, the opportunities you're lucky enough to, you know, to be given. So, yeah.
Got it. All right, I got this other question. This is, like, the first time I've ever asked a question like this, but it goes like this. Most of the world thinks X, but I see it differently, and because I see it differently, it's helped me tremendously. Is there anything that kind of pops up in your mind where, like, you know, most people or the world thinks, you know, like this, but I see things kind of differently? Anything kind of pop up?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to jump on that one. I'm sure if I gave enough thought, but just, like, I don't presume to, like, there's not a lot, you know, that separates me from everyone else where I feel I'm so, you know, so special that I can, you know, look past everybody else in that. Like, I've been very lucky throughout my career. You know, luck is very helpful, and I wouldn't look past that at all. You know, and then the rest is there's a lot of experience. From seeing things to help, you know, shape future decision making. So, yeah, wouldn't presume to put myself as a total standout visionary.
Yeah, got it. Jared, this has been actually quite fascinating. I love your story and just how you're pushing things with not just company entrepreneurship, but also space, giving back to places like St. Jude. What do you see? This is probably, you know, as I wrap up, like, what do you see, like, the next, you know, 10 years, you know, for you? Do you have any more longer term goals, either company or personal or anything else?
Well, there's a lot there. I mean, mostly to say is, like, I am fortunate to be associated with some pretty extraordinary organizations. I mean, starting right with the company that's, you know, afforded me so many opportunities in life, which is Shift4. So I'm the largest shareholder. You know, I'm like, that is the vast majority of my time, and we're going to go global. I mean, that is the focus right now. I mean, that is the single biggest thing we can do to create value at Shift4 is do everything that's driving all of our growth and success here in the United States and take it into new geographies, and just, like, dramatically increase our TAM when, you know, we have, like, a significant right to win advantage. And, you know, So in any case, like, that's what I'm going to focus on with Shift4. I'm also, you know, lucky to be associated with St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. And, we raised, you know, over $250 million. They need more. And it's like, they don't, you know, they have a pretty ambitious goal and one that's worth meeting, which is, again, no child should die in the dawn of life. So I'm going to continue to do that. And third, again, you know, there is a relationship there with SpaceX, and anything I can do to kind of be supportive on their incredible vision, which is make life multiplanetary. So I have no doubt there's people going to be walking on Mars in our lifetime. I think there could be people walking on Mars in the next 10 years. And that's exciting. I think the world is more interesting when things like that are happening. And I'll do whatever I can to support them in their efforts, too.
Awesome. Thanks. I'll go ahead and link to your Twitter profile in the video description, also to Shift4's website, ticker symbol 4, F-O-U-R. Thanks again, Jared, for taking the time out to share your life story and things about your company. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for your time. Great questions.
All right. Thanks, Jared. We'll see you. Bye.